Hello. Welcome to another episode of the Open Physio Podcast, where I speak to authors who have published in the journal in an attempt to understand a little bit more about their motivations and processes for conducting the research that they've shared with the journal. In this episode, I speak with Sean Cleaver from the Faculty of Medicine and Health Sciences at McGill University in Canada, Siddhi Prada Mohapatra from the Department of Physiotherapy at the Manipal College of Health Professions in India, and Mathieu Samad, a PhD candidate at McGill University in Canada. These authors submitted an article entitled Contagious Precarity, a collective biographical analysis of early career physiotherapy academics' experiences of the COVID-19 pandemic. During the peer review process, the authors were asked to remove some of the contents of the article, which the reviewers thought were tangential to the main thrust of the piece. I wanted to use the podcast as a way for them to include and expand on some of the ideas that were excluded from the published version of the paper that I thought were useful to discuss. Welcome, Mathieu, Sean, and Siddhi. I really appreciate you giving up the time to talk a little bit more about your article that you submitted to the journal. As part of that process, I know that the reviewers gave some feedback that led to you cutting out quite a bit of the article. And having read the whole thing prior to the final edited version going up, I thought that there was a lot of value that you included in the original submission, which ended up not making it into the final version. And I thought this would be a really good opportunity for us to talk about what it was that you had to cut out, and maybe for us to explore some of those ideas in a little bit more depth, because I thought there were some really important and valuable ideas that you added to that. But before we talk about that kind of tangent, that supplementary material, maybe we could just start off just very briefly talking about the main thrust of the paper, and we'll include links in the show notes to the final article, and then we'll also include this conversation alongside the final paper. But maybe, Sean, I could ask you to come in and maybe just give us a very, very brief introduction to what the final publication was about.
Absolutely, and thank you for this opportunity, Michael. So the final version that we ended up publishing was a little bit more focused than some of our discussions had been leading up to that. And what we landed on was a brief account of what life was like for us as early career academics working in physiotherapy departments during the early phases of the COVID-19 pandemic, particularly the first few months. And to give this a bit of a more systematic analysis, we used a framework suggested by some colleagues in occupational therapy and social work, specifically Freeman and Jovin. So we reviewed our lived experiences through the lens of that framework, so that it created more of a systematic account of those early pandemic experiences.
Thanks a lot, Sean. That's a really good background. And as I say, the link to that article is in the show notes. But I think today what we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit about some of the things that had to be left out. And from my reading of it, one of the big ideas that had to be cut out was this idea of the precariat. And I think, you know, from the main kind of thrust of what you guys are talking about, you wanted to look at that concept in a little bit more depth. Maybe we could start by just very briefly talking about what that is, what the concept entails, and who does it include?
The precariat is an idea that I have been following for a while. I've come across it being named in more academic type forums, but it's something that I feel that we see all over the place. For example, the switch in North America from more regulated and official taxi services to using Uber more frequently, that there's been an evolution in styles of work that have been designed intentionally to make workers more precarious, and that there are structures that are encouraging this process, including in academia. And I'm most familiar with what this looks like from the experience that Mathieu and I are in Canada, where we had a model of university departments being based more fully on folks with long-term tenure track positions, and that these are increasingly being replaced by contract teaching and contract research where workers can come and go. And there's a constant struggle to make sure that you're rehired next year. So I see this precariat structure functioning in workplaces more broadly in society. I see it happening in universities. So it's happening on a larger scale, and it's happening on a very micro scale that I'm experiencing as a worker.
Mathieu and Sidi, do you want to come in and add to that some of your own experience? Sidi, you got your hand up. Do you want to go ahead?
So I'm very glad what Sean has spoken about the larger population and then narrowed it down to what we are experiencing. Definitely the contract-based culture which has been adopted, because we belong to a culture where it was not more of capitalistic oriented. We were working with faith and trust. So a work was not so professional in our culture. So we had decades generations of worker who used to be associated with an organization or a particular kind of work. That's how things were over here. But yes, definitely the precarity has become so prevalent in many of the occupations here. Talk about the very basic unorganized sectors to organized sectors, including the academia. Take, for instance, with respect to research, it would not be only physiotherapy or medical profession. It has become a culture for every form of higher education.
You mentioned something about faith and trust, and I think that's such a nice way of putting it. And so you're talking about that loss of faith and trust and a movement towards a more instrumental or kind of capitalist framework that governs how we think about higher education and work within academia. Is that right?
So it's become more of I work only for benefits, or I work only because I'm getting compensation for my work. So I work only for that. I don't work to serve the better purpose. I don't work for the better goal.
Yeah, I think you've touched on some really great ideas. Faith, trust, service. And you're right, when we see these things, when we see our work as purely instrumental or purely as a result of a financial interaction, then something is lost. Mathieu, do you want to come in?
Yes, I would love to be able to build on that, you know, because we should not forget where did precariat come from initially. You know, in thinking about this overhaul system, and as pointed out Sidi, this capitalist system, where basically it was made as a system where we could pressure the unit of production, you know, to get the most outputs as possible with the less outputs. But the big question here is, we know it was intended to increase the production, you know, in capitalist society to start with. But is it really something that's actually compatible both with the academic system, with the university, but also with the healthcare system? And that's really something that I think here we want to challenge. Because these disparities, you know, between wanting to have the most outputs from the lesser outputs will actually pressure workers, but goes completely, for me, against the role of caring that we as physiotherapists have as central to our profession. And for me, it also poses these bigger questions in terms of academics based in universities, where we always talk about this academic liberty, but this precariat, whereby you need to produce the most, you need to basically follow your orders, will go completely against the idea of academic liberty as well. So I would propose that this system is actually contrary to the objectives that we should have as a profession. And that's something we should re-examine and not just take it as granted.
Thanks for that additional context, Mathieu. And I think that kind of leads us into something that you had mentioned prior to this recording, which was this idea of academia as either reinforcing or, what is you said, or emancipating from the social class. And I was wondering, you know, I'm kind of passingly familiar with some of Bell Hooks's work, where she talks about education as the practice of freedom. And I was wondering if that was kind of where you were heading with that comment that you had made about academia and the structures of academia, either reinforcing the existing structures or emancipating us from some of those more oppressive ideas.
Exactly. Because there's this idea, you know, whereby I realize that the more we are going to be trained in university, the more, if you can say, in a mold we become. So we provide, well, we think of university as this place of knowledge generation. But what I see is the further we go into in terms of advanced studies and advanced degrees, the more we're becoming part of this mold whereby we're taught about the methodologies to follow, the authors to follow, and not necessarily in terms of emancipation, in terms of promoting creativity and originality in that perspective. I also see another aspect, you know, of university as a place of emancipation or not. Whereby taking, for example, my personal example, whereby two generations ago, you know, my grandparents, you know, were barely able to read and write. So it's also economically a factor that can promote emancipation and having the opportunity to have higher income opportunities and employment. However, it can also help to recreate those class divisions, because who gets access to university? And I have to be honest, in Canada, it's being more and more and more restrained, despite being a rich country with access to loans and bursaries, whereby we see that there's this big tendencies, as used to be beforehand, whereby richer persons or sons of and children of persons who went to university have easier access. So it can be used to emancipate from your class, but can also reproduce that same class divisions that we see and spy, you know, the notion of precariat coming back again at university. So I think there's an intellectual component to that, but I think there's a very real, I would say, socioeconomic division that can also be reproduced by university, in which we need to be very careful about.
I think as you were talking, I was reminded of a book that came out in 2019 by Daniel Markovitz, just called The Meritocracy Trap. And it's just this idea that, you know, people within that structure who are, you know, we're just recycling our children into that system, and it becomes increasingly difficult for anyone else to enter into the system. We think that we are rewarding the people who are working the hardest as part of a meritocracy. But we're not actually seeing that the structure of the system is exclusive. It prevents other people from entering into that system. So once you're in, you're kind of constantly able to escalate your rewards as part of the system, but you can't, it's actually really difficult to get into it. Sidi, do you want to come in on that?
Yes. So actually we are all, four of us are placed, I see that way apart globally, but we have so much similar positions right now with respect to access to higher universities. It need not be only pertaining to the socioeconomic structure, but it could be the language, because there are definitely a larger section of Indian population who's been educated for the past 12 years of their life in vernacular system of language, whereas higher educations are being taught again and again, are being moving towards English. So that itself can also lead to divisions within the higher education system. Just to add a point about what Matthew spoke about university and emancipation. Actually, university, the onus on university increases to be a part of emancipatory practice. One, because they have resources. I'm not talking about financial resource, but technical resource, knowledge-based resource, human resource. They have so much of it. So the onus on a higher education university is way more compared to general population. any other practice. We have access to multidisciplinary education. If we have that, that's the best to actually grow an emancipatory practice, and thereby that shifts the onus on an university to a greater extent, would be my views.
Sidi, there's a couple of points that you touched on, and I'll just use it to lead into another point that you had mentioned earlier to our conversation. The idea of the dominance of English as a language in higher education, and I'm going to link to another conversation that I had with Sean. We'll put that link in the show notes about that exact problem. And I know that's something that Sean has spoken about a lot recently. But you talked about this idea of the multidisciplinary resources that are available in higher education institutions. And that kind of leads us towards this idea of this collective solidarity versus individualism that seems to be privileged in higher education institutions. And maybe Sean, you could come in on that idea.
It's interesting that there is movement happening in many different directions. So here we are having this conversation today with two of us in different locations in Quebec, CD in India, you, Michael, in South Africa. And there are many aspects of common perspectives and common experiences among us. So the fact that we're able to team up and challenge some trends that we're seeing that are also pushing in the same directions in each of our respective countries and our respective institutions, I think is emblematic of how there are forces pushing in that direction of atomization and individualization at the same time that there are forces pushing back against it. And it's at least interesting for us to think about that. In the one sense, even though our statuses might be precarious, at least all of us are able to take home a paycheck with a socially justified reason to be able to think about these things. So I do want to be able to recognize that level of privilege that is not necessarily afforded to the person who's delivering groceries up and down my street in this time of pandemic lockdown. But in addition to just being something that we think about, it is a tool that exists at our disposal. That social movements are successful because they have the weight of enough people who are seeing problems and proposing solutions to work against them. I feel that my own work has sort of been on the boundaries of this, that this conversation right now is an example of collective solidarity in action, that writing that paper in the first place that was born from a conversation between CD, Matsu, and I about problems that we were having approximately 1 year ago now in that early pandemic phase. Those are examples of collective solidarity. But it's a topic that is so much bigger than academia, than our situation as physiotherapists who are interested in the responsibility of our profession. I feel like at best what I can offer for this conversation today is just to draw the attention of other physiotherapists, colleagues to these issues. I think I won't speak on behalf of everyone, but I think that we're familiar with the tendency of our profession to lean towards the technical, to be really interested with the mobility of the lumbar spine at a more expansive but not expansive enough level to talk about the biopsychosocial, which is really just a more expansive way to talk about the mobility of the lumbar spine. So if we can have these ideas circulate more within the physiotherapy profession and draw more attention to them, I think that we'll penetrate deeper into talking about collective solidarity and where we might fit within it, where we as precarious academics should align forces with the enormous percentage of our populations that are also precarious workers, and how we can team up to make the changes that we know need to be made.
Thanks, Sean. Matthew, do you want to come in and add to that?
Yes, I think Sean, you know, read in my mind in the sense that we've been exchanging a lot on those aspects. But effectively, I believe, you know, a lot of the health professions, and I include into that physical therapy, really focus on that individualistic approach. We, as a carer, working for one patient. But that doesn't take into account who doesn't get access to physical therapy services, who can't afford physical therapy services. And strangely enough, I don't see this discussion about public health in-service provision being discussed at all in our basic trainings. And really, the solutions to those challenges of who has been left out will not come from individualistic approaches. It's going to come from a collective solidarity approach by the physiotherapy profession. So I would really think that we have more to offer in terms of public health approaches than what is normally done in terms of performance of training. I think these reflections and questioning needs to be approached and shared and discussed a lot more in our profession. And I think there's also this aspect, you know, of we tend to see, you know, as you said, the individual hero. So who is the biggest physiotherapist? Who has the biggest name? But it don't get to that, I would say, recognition by themselves. You know, we're all the project, you know, of the teams we're working in. We're all the projects, as Sean said, also of the privileges. You know, how much resources do I have access to, for example, to be able to be at the forefront? So I think we need to put up in these discussions. I think we need to have more of a collective approach for public health. And last but not least, you know, looking at Freeman and Jovain framework of analysis, which we used for this article, you know, you realize, you know, we wrote the article in the first months of the pandemic, but now being more than a year into that, the solution, at least for me, is also going through this collective solidarity, because how do I deal with all the difficulties I experience in terms of the request of the work, you know, as a teacher, as a clinician, and so on? I found a lot of the answers I found in the collective solidarity of my colleagues, such as Sidi, Sean, yourself, and others around me. So I really see that as a collective way for us to go forward.
As I was listening to you, Matthew, I couldn't stop thinking about a speech that Barack Obama gave, and one of the things that he said, which was taken a lot out of context by a certain group of people, was you didn't build that. You didn't build the internet that you use to build your company. You didn't build the roads, you know, and we need to acknowledge that everything that we do is building on the contributions of, you know, an enormous group of people who we don't recognize. We think that we are self-made in every way, rather than being kind of humble in the people who have come before us and who have kind of paved the road that we use to get to where we are. So thanks so much, Matthew, for expanding on some of those ideas. Sidi, you put your hand up. You wanted to come in earlier.
Thank you. You actually quoted him at the right time, Mr. Obama. Just to bring in the previous context of the university's culture and how that has actually promoted individualistic approach and put this down, and also touching upon the aspect of why universities have a greater onus, because they are actually training younger generations to become a professional. So that's where we actually can set an example, like public health approach. So the student is actually then becomes more responsible towards others, sees the others, and not becomes more focused towards capitalistic gain. So that's why the onus on university is far greater. At the training stage itself, when the other day I was talking to Philip also, we usually see some magazines, which professional is the highest paid professional per hour, which profession gets. To see physiotherapy, there are many of my students who have come and told me, we feel proud that we are a profession which is highest paid in US. It saddens me because they do not understand how that is going, that is changing their mentality, that is changing the trust which they should build into primary prevention, into public health approach. They are becoming more and more towards financial gain.
Thanks so much, Sidi. One of the last things that I noted in some of the notes that we had passed around before this conversation was the idea of writing as a way of reflecting on some of these ideas.
And like, I think a lot about writing as thinking. You know, we often think, make an idea concrete, and then we write about the idea. And I think sometimes it's useful to switch that around and to think of the act of writing as a way of thinking. So not to have the idea perfect, and then you put it down onto paper, but we write as a way of thinking. And I was wondering if the three of you, earlier, Sean, you talked about this idea of teaming up, that you kind of dispersed, you separated. Can you talk a little bit about your the way that you came together, the way that your collective ideas kind of manifested and were refined through the act of writing this paper?
I'd love to speak to it a little bit, and I imagine that my colleagues will add on to my reflections as well. Well, one thing that I will say as a starting point is that the act of writing was helpful for our collective thought process, and also it was kind of an empowering opportunity in that all three of us feel pressure to publish. So the fact that we were able to take a real world problem that we experienced and turn into a publication, that was in our thought process from the start. It felt a little bit like using the master's tools, maybe not to completely dismantle the master's house, but to do some renos that make it look a little bit different. In addition to that, it, I think, allowed our collective thoughts to evolve in a way that was a bit more asynchronous. So the idea for the paper began just through a discussion where we were literally checking up on each other at a stage where there's still lots of concern right now, a year after the pandemic has been declared, but at that time there was even more unknown and confusion and even fear, definitely an uncertainty that we all experienced. So we began with a discussion that was really just checking in to make sure that everyone was okay, recognized our commonalities. We're able to rapid fire lots of ideas between us, but in the intervening weeks between meeting, the act of writing allowed us to make those a bit more clear. Also with the intention to share these with other people. So that aspect of taking something that could be really ephemeral for a conversation between us and to be able to expand them out in time and to expand them out to other audiences is something that feels very powerful. It means that the ideas are, they have more longevity and more audience. So those are a few reflections on my side as to what that act of writing was useful for us.
Mathieu or Sidi, do you want to add anything to that?
Yes. Actually, what happened was very interesting now that we look back 1 year beyond this. It was, like Sean said, just some minor conversations we were having and just pouring out our anxiety, what is going to happen. Anxieties at different levels because of various other reasons. That led to something so beautiful and such beautifully crafted article as you have read. Here, actually, I want to stress something and will also reflect on emancipation, university culture, university responsibility, will be that we chose this particular journal because it was open to ideas like this. And yes, Sean was the one who actually gave us the options of this. And both me and Mathieu went through the already published articles. And then we got to know, okay, this. What I want to stress here is this journal is actually very right to its name, Open Physio. It's quite open. And it beats that notion of indexing and non-indexing of journals, which was also a concern all three of us had shared at that point of time. But we still went ahead. We wanted to publish it in this particular journal because of the idealism this particular journal has been built on. And thank you for that.
Well, thank you, Sidi, for kind of recognizing that. I think one of the things that we are trying to do with the journal is to provide a channel for people to share ideas that may be difficult to share in more traditional publication outlets. The other thing about indexing, I hear what you're saying, and you probably don't know this, but we've recently been accepted to be indexed in the Directory of Open Access Journals. And we're working on slowly getting indexed by all of the other big indices. So we are slowly becoming a real journal. We'll get there eventually. Matthew, you've got your hand up. Do you want to come in?
Yes, thank you. Because I think it's very useful, because effectively for me, the writing was also a way of reflecting. But part of it was personal reflection. Part of it is also to go back to that idea of collective reflection, and which I think it was really useful. And it also was really useful for me, at least on the, I would say on a personal perspective, you know, because the life of graduate student and young academic, everything is defined by those individualistic indicators, you know. How many articles you published? How many funds did you receive? How many bursaries did you receive? How big was your impact, you know, just as we discussed, of all the articles you published, but it was never a discussion of a team, you know? So whenever, and it's not, you know, a long, quiet journey, I have to say. So this fact to be together and realize that actually, even though we each have different positions, we come from different countries, we each have responsibilities. And here I'll acknowledge, you know, cities, you know, has even more pressures than me and Sean, you know. How do you balance that obligation of publishing with, you know, taking care of the toddler at the same time, you know? All these pressures are all individualistic, and for me, it allowed us to regain control by working together and saying to this institution, no, it's not only the individual. It has Sean pointed out, you know, it's quite ironic that we could actually use the tools by which our individual performance is measured to perform it. But I found this also both a collective support side to writing together, allowing for reflection, and almost like an exutory tool that we can use, you know, providing this article. And thank you very much, as Sidi pointed out, you know, that you accepted that, because most journals wouldn't necessarily be open to such, I would say, revolutionary ideas. Thank you.
No problem at all. I think it was a really interesting and insightful paper that came at a good time. A couple of years ago, I was invited to speak at our faculty research day, and I presented something called I Am Not My H Index. And the entire presentation was just about how we need to move away from these kind of individual metrics of, you know, what's your H index? How many publications have you submitted? You know, how much funds have you received? And to really acknowledge that the article is a really poor proxy indicator for impact. And if you want to demonstrate impact, looking at a formal academic publication might even be the worst indicator that you could use for some kind of meaningful idea of whether or not you made an impact in the world. Sidi, Matthew, and Sean, I really appreciate you giving up a little bit of your time to talk some more about your article. I think it's a great paper, and as I've said before, we're going to link to it in the show notes. And I really hope that everyone goes to have a look at it. I think it's got some really important points. So thanks very much.